Hello, everybody. We are really excited to have you here with us today. My name is Erin Cameron, and I am the Development and Outreach Coordinator for SAFE. I will be the facilitator for today's webinar, Federal Clean Energy Standard Policy Impacts on the Southeast. On behalf of SAFE, I'd like to thank you for attending today's webinar. Your interest and support are critical to the work that we do. We will be recording this webinar, so all the lines have been muted to assure recording quality. I encourage you to type in your questions using the questions option on your control panel. We will then answer the questions in the order they are received at the very end of the presentation. I also want to add that all the material from this presentation will be available on our website, cleanenergy.org. I also want to mention that we do have a lot of people on the webinar today, so there may be a slight delay in our slide progression, so please bear with us. It shouldn't affect too much. For those of you not familiar with SAFE, we are a regional organization focused on promoting responsible energy choices that create global warming solutions and ensure clean, safe, and healthy communities throughout the Southeast. SAFE has been a leading voice for energy policy to protect the quality of life and treasure places in the Southeast since 1985. We are a membership organization, and I'd like to thank all of our members on this call today and encourage those of you who are not members to please join us today. And I'd now like to turn the presentation over to Simon Mahan, SAFE's Renewable Energy Manager. Simon?
Thanks, Erin. So, as Erin said, my name is Simon Mahan. I'm the Renewable Energy Manager for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm based out of Lafayette, Louisiana. However, we do focus on the entire region, which effectively covers what we generally call the South. Erin, could you advance to the next slide here? Thank you. So this is just an overview of what I'm going to run through today, and generally we're going to be talking about the proposed federal clean energy standard legislation. There hasn't been one reintroduced into the 113th Congress for several reasons, but we are going to evaluate some of the assessments completed by the Energy Information Administration on previous proposals of the clean energy standard type. So today we'll talk about some disclaimers about the data that I'm about to share with you and some of the analysis that I'm about to share. We'll talk about a bit of history with the Clean Energy Standard and its chronological history. We'll touch on the variables of some proposed clean energy standards. Then we'll dive into data and analysis on a national assessment, compare that to the Southeast assessment, and then offer an addendum of additional information provided by EIA on a more recent note. But before we go too much further, I don't want to bury the lead. There's a lot of very interesting information throughout all of this, but I do want to touch briefly on implications for the Southeast immediately. So folks, hopefully this will perk your ears up and make you more interested to stay on for the rest of the presentation. First and foremost, under the clean energy standards proposals that we've looked at and that have been analyzed by EIA, there appears to be just a massive nuclear expansion in the South. And under these proposed clean energy standards, by the year 2035, it would be expected that under a clean energy standard law, that about half of all electric generation in the South would be nuclear. Costs for the entire region generally go up. There is also additionally very little renewable energy developed within the region, but within the region as a whole, biomass becomes the largest renewable energy resource under a clean energy standard. Conventional hydropower, which is currently number one, goes to number two. Solar also expands, but it's mostly at end-user locations like homes and residences. Wind energy expands under the clean energy standards. However, compared to a business-as-usual case where nothing is done, where no clean energy standard is passed, only about 500 additional megawatts of wind energy are built in the South under a clean energy standard. Within all of this, there is no offshore wind energy developed at all, which was a little surprising to me, because offshore wind is a very valuable resource for the South, and North Carolina is generally considered to have the best offshore wind resource in the country. And total electric generation for the region actually dips a bit, between 3% and 6%, possibly showing additional energy conservation or energy efficiency measures, potentially because the costs of electricity have gone up. So with that kind of teaser, I do want to go on to the next slide here of disclaimers that the presentation that I'm about to give and the white paper that we developed, the white paper is in conjunction with this presentation. The white paper is available online, and we'll have a link for it later in this presentation. But all of this relies on EIA figures. These are not SACE figures. They are EIA figures, data, and methodology. We do not evaluate the soundness of that information, and though that information may rely on potentially faulty or incomplete information, we do not, in the white paper or on this presentation, take a specific position on a clean energy standard, its variables, its alternatives, any way to tweak it in any sort of fashion. We just want to look at what has been done to evaluate what a CES does for the region and then present those results here. However, this presentation and the white paper does provide a general reference point of possible outcomes of proposed variables for not yet introduced legislation. So what I want you all to take away from this is that there are a lot of moving pieces and none of these are completely set in stone. So if it sounds like I'm a little bit lax with reporting of specificity of the numbers, keep in mind the numbers themselves are not 100% firm. Anytime that you're looking out to projections for, you know, 20, 25 years, there is going to be a little bit of wiggle room in that. The other thing is this paper and the presentation I'm about to give do not evaluate all the impacts of electrical generation associated with it. So we do not look at water consumption, which is a major concern for us in the Southeast. We do not look at the effects of property values or of different types of pollution generated or mining or anything of that sort. So there's an awful lot that still needs to be done to evaluate all the implications of a clean energy standard that we do not look at here. So we're just going to try and run through some of the numbers of what it looks like for electric generation. Next slide. This is more of a chronological history on a clean energy standard, and clearly it's not comprehensive. But basically, a clean energy standard has been proposed after the failure of the federal government to pass a renewable electric standard, or an RES, could also be called a renewable portfolio standard. Effectively, an RES or an RPS sets a minimum amount of renewable electricity. Renewable electricity is, of course, the generation types like wind and solar and biomass, hydro, marine, hydrokinetic. But historically, the states have done a very, very good job at passing RPSs and have been wildly successful with them. At the federal level, however, this has not been so. So as an alternative to a renewable energy standard, which you know, a renewable energy standard might call for 20% of the nation's electrical capacity to come from renewable energy by, you know, 2025 or 2030. The proposed clean energy standard would increase the definition of what qualifying facilities could be used. So not only would it include the renewable energy, which folks have been very, very supportive of, but it would include some other sources of energy such as nuclear, natural gas, certain types of natural gas, carbon capture sequestration for coal, certain types of coal-fired power generation. And effectively, a clean energy standard is really a low carbon standard. The heart of a clean energy standard is to try and stave off greenhouse gas emissions, specifically carbon dioxide. So after the renewable energy standard failed several times to actually become law at the federal level, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, introduced the Clean Energy Standard in 2010. A year later, President Obama, in his State of the Union address, said he supported a clean energy standard. He was not too much specific about that. However, the language he used suggested he supported something that along the lines of what Senator Graham had proposed. And then surprisingly, President Obama also suggested support for a clean energy standard in his 2012 State of the Union address as well. It is quite possible, and for folks that are policy wonks like myself, on the State of the Union address on February the 12th, listen to see if President Obama mentions a clean energy standard again. And if so, this discussion and white paper that I'm about to run through becomes even more relevant to the policy discussions in the 113th Congress. In 2011, Representative Hall, Ralph Hall from Texas, wrote to the Energy Information Administration asking them to do an analysis on what effects a clean energy standard would have. And as such, Representative Hall put together a list of variables and a list of requirements on a clean energy standard that he submitted to the EIA. He got his results back, and he touted the results as an expensive form of new federal regulation to limit greenhouse gas emissions, so he was not too favorable to a clean energy standard. In response to Representative Hall's request to EIA, Senator Bingaman, a Democrat from New Mexico, requested EIA do another analysis with some slightly different variables. And by doing Senator Bingaman's analysis, he came up with a cheaper way to do a clean energy standard. But both of those analyses were completed by November of 2011. Shortly thereafter, in 2012, Senator Bingaman actually introduced a clean energy standard himself. It's called the Clean Energy Standard Act of 2012. It's not very unique in its name. But Senator Bingaman has had a very, very long history of being a renewable energy standard champion at the federal level. So this was a bit of departure from what he has done previously, supporting renewable energy specifically, but he went a step further to include nuclear, natural gas, and certain types of coal in his Clean Energy Standard Act. Senator Bingaman then had a hearing on his bill in the Senate, and as such, the EIA updated their analysis to specifically look at CESA in May of 2012. And this is what the addendum is. It's the very last slide, the very last thing that I'll be talking about. But Senator Bingaman has retired, and he is no longer in Congress, so he will not be able to reintroduce his legislation. Nevertheless, there is still interest in a clean energy standard from both sides of the aisle, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of debate we end up having in the near term. Next slide. Now, the analysis that I'm going to be sharing with you is from the older 2011 EIA figures. And the reason why I wanted to look at this as opposed to including the addendum information was because EIA messed with their methodology and their cost estimates a bit, so they're not quite as comparable as what one would think. However, this is a couple of the primary variables between a Bingaman Clean Energy Standard, so that's BCES, and a Hall, Representative Hall, Clean Energy Standard, or a HCES, so that's what those acronyms are. And generally, between the two of them, on the left-hand side, you can see that both of them require a fairly high percentage of, quote, clean energy by the year 2035 and potentially further on down. Both of them require an 80% clean energy requirement on the nation by the year 2035. Representative Hall said that that was a cap and that it would be left to that until about 2050, whereas Bingaman recommended that that number actually go up past the year 2035. But in reality, that actually didn't change too much. That didn't mean too much for the EIA analysis, since EIA only can project out to the year 2035. So the numbers that we're going to be looking at will be for the year 2035 as opposed to year 2050, which is generally the year that scientists look for climate change assessments. On the right-hand side, we have these are effectively the definitions of what clean energy is for these two competing proposals. As you can see, generally the renewable energies, so biomass, geothermal, landfill gas, solar, wind, hydro, those all receive a 1, which indicates a full credit of a clean energy credit under the legislation. So if they generate a megawatt hour of electricity, the generator then receives one credit, one full credit of clean energy. the credit number is supposed to be based on a relative figure of how much carbon dioxide they're emitting into the air. So a higher number means they are emitting lower amounts of carbon dioxide or not emitting carbon dioxide at all, as in the case of these renewable energies. Then it goes further with Bingaman et al. To also include nuclear, which is not a renewable energy resource. It also includes natural gas with CCS, which is carbon capture and sequestration, at a fairly high level of a credit. It also includes coal with a CCS, new natural gas combined cycle, existing natural gas combined cycle, certain types of natural gas combustion, which is a different technology using natural gas as a fuel. Then the kind of some more differences here with Bingaman is that he also includes integrated gasification combined coal, combined cycle coal, so it gets a little bit of a credit, but not much. And then kind of the really big differences here is how they both treat existing hydro and existing nuclear power. Under Hall's proposal, existing hydro, so it could be 50 years, could be 75 years old, would receive one credit. And existing nuclear, again, could be 40, 50 years old, receives one full credit. Whereas under Bingaman's proposal, both of these types of generation do not receive any credit at all. But they do count towards the total goal. So under Bingaman's proposal, if you had, let's say, 10% hydro, hydroelectric power, that had already existed and your standard was an 80% standard, you would subtract the 10% that you already have from the new proposed standard. So instead of having 80%, you subtract the 10% and you'd have a 70% standard that you'd have to meet. So I hope that's as clear as mud. If anybody has any questions about the variables and more about the Bingaman and Hall proposals, feel free to get in touch with me after the presentation. But we're going to go ahead and plow on to the next slide. This is just jumping right into the analysis here, and I want to remind everyone of the disclaimers I flashed up earlier. If you look at the EIA numbers without evaluating the validity of those figures, these are the implications of the nation's generation resources for the year 2035. Coal generation drops by about half, gas increases by about 30 to 50%, nuclear either declines under Bingaman's proposal or increases, as in under Hall's proposal. I do want to flag here that this will change with the addendum, and in fact, it's more likely that nuclear will expand and expand by quite a lot, as by Bingaman's most recent legislation. The wind and biomass increase, they both increase over the business as usual case, but they still only represent a small amount of the total electric mix by the year 2035. So here on the chart, it looks like they're wildly successful, but we'll see another chart that suggests otherwise here shortly. Hydropower remains relatively static. Geothermal increases a small amount, and petroleum generation declines ever so slightly. Next. So this is the image that I wanted everybody to see of what the EIA is actually projecting out to be our energy mixes. Under the business as usual scenario, the BAU 2035, it's the very top pie chart there, we would be expecting to receive about 85% of our electricity from coal, gas, and nuclear combined. And under both CES scenarios, we would get about 77, 78, high 70s, of our electricity would be coming from those same resources, albeit at different levels. Under Bingaman's proposal, coal and gas effectively flip roles, and under the Hall scenario, gas and nuclear take up a bit more of coal's reduction. Delving in a bit more to the renewables, wind energy becomes about 6 or 7% of the nation's generation resource. I do want to remind folks that this is a very far cry from what the Department of Energy's 20% by 2030 report outlines, where 20% of the nation's electricity could come from wind power by 2030. Hydropower stays relatively the same at about 6%. Biomass stays at about 6%, or increases, sorry, to about 6%. Geothermal becomes about 1%. and solar maxes out at about 0.5%, so half of a percentage point. If you add up all these renewable energy technologies together, they represent about 20% of total electric generation. So if you were to put this another way, under both of these scenarios, renewable energy on a nationwide level represents about as much electricity as coal under both CES options. If you were to just look at this in terms of renewables and try to compare it to a renewable electricity standard, this would effectively be a 20% renewable electricity standard by the year 2035. Next slide. The EIA did go a bit deeper into emissions evaluations on what the clean energy standards would end up coming up with. Slightly more sulfur dioxides, or SO2, and nitrous oxides, or NOx, are reduced by the Hall proposal as opposed to the Bingaman proposal. Both reduce those emissions more than doing nothing, which is the business as usual scenario. I did want to highlight estimated emission levels in the year 2009 so folks can kind of get a benchmark of where we're at and where we're going. Meanwhile, the Hall proposal reduces carbon dioxide emissions quite a bit better than the Bingaman scenario, and it's potentially because of its greater reliance on nuclear power. Mainstream science generally suggests that in order to stave off the worst effects of climate change, the United States portion of carbon dioxide reductions needs to be an 80% decline over 1990 levels. And as you can see, by the year 2035, neither one of these options quite gets to that level, although it appears Hall is getting closer. Keep in mind, these reduction numbers are based on the year 2009, not 1990. So we're already 20 years off, or two decades off, of where we need to be. So neither one of these is a magic silver bullet to stop climate change. Next. So now that we've kind of looked at the national scene, we're going to delve down a bit more into the South and focus in on the Southern assessment. In order to do that, the EIA broke up the region, or broke up the country, into these different electric balancing units. And the units that we're going to be focusing on are the four subregions in the southeast portion of the United States. So SRVC stands for SERC Virginia Carolinas. Then we have SERC Central for Tennessee and Kentucky, SERC Delta, which includes Arkansas, Louisiana, some of Mississippi, and some of Texas, SERC Southeast, which is mostly Georgia and Alabama, and then we have the Florida Reliability Council, which is most of Florida. If you hear those terms, so Virginia's, we're talking about Virginia and the Carolinas, Central, again, is Kentucky and Tennessee, Delta is Arkansas and Louisiana and Mississippi. Southeast is generally, again, Georgia and Alabama, and then we have Florida as well. I do want to remind folks of that because that's as granular of data that we have available. So if you're interested in a particular state, those are the regions you're going to want to look at next. Next slide. And this is just zooming in a bit better on those regions so you can see what they are and what they mean. So we have Carolinas and Virginia, Central, Delta, Southeast, and Florida. Next. This is an estimate for all five subregions within the South combined. So as you can see, nuclear becomes the predominant source of electricity in 2035 under both clean energy standard proposals. Coal declines, natural gas increases a bit, and renewable energy remains quite marginal. You can't see it on this chart, but electric generation generally declines across the region, not by much. Again, I think it was 3-6% that I mentioned at the onset, but possibly due to higher electricity costs. Next. And here's those cost estimates that are why I think it's potential that the electricity usage actually declines. Overall, the rates for the region are expected to increase over a business as usual scenario for all parts of the region under a Bingaman scenario. And at a higher rate than the national average. The national average, the U.S. average, is the very last one down there where we see generally a 20% increase. And under the Hall scenario, rates may not increase as much as the national average. However, there are some subregions such as Florida and the Tennessee and Kentucky area of Central that would increase much, much faster than the Hall scenario. Next. So we'll start off here with Carolinas and Virginia. And within Carolinas and Virginia, coal-based generation declines about 70% under both clean energy standard options compared to the business as usual scenario in the year 2035. So here we are in the year 2035, and this is what it could potentially look like. Natural gas electric generation increases between about 30% and about 90%. So it sounds like it's increasing an awful lot, but it still remains a relatively small amount of electric generation under both clean energy standards. It represents about 6% under both of the CESs. Nuclear energy, that's clearly the big change for the Carolinas and Virginia here. Nuclear energy could substantially increase anywhere from a half to 80%. Meaning that nuclear would account for about 66 to 70% of our electric generation in the Carolinas and Virginia under a clean energy standard. So a massive, massive increase in nuclear electricity generation. And meanwhile, while all this is going on, renewables do increase slightly, but they only reach about 9% of total generation for this subregion by the year 2035. So again, that's effectively a 9% renewable energy standard by the year 2035 if you were looking at other options. Next. Here we're talking about the central region, which again is including Kentucky and Tennessee mostly, where we see coal-based electric generation declines about 40-45% under the clean energy standard options. Central, between the five region, actually maintains the most amount of coal out of all of these scenarios for the region. And it's potential that under the EIA analyses, they actually were looking more towards retrofitting the coal plants to include carbon capture and sequestration, because the numbers here are just way higher for coal usage in the year 2035 than any other part of the region. Natural gas electric generation increases, it basically doubles for both scenarios, but still it remains fairly small compared to other generation resources. It only represents about 13% of our electricity. Nuclear declines by 1% under Bingaman, but it increases slightly by about 7%. So overall, nuclear remains effectively the same under both clean energy standards, and it remains to be about 30% of our electric generation. But renewable generation actually increases quite a bit to 17%. Currently, under the business as usual scenario that's used by EIA, it looks like most of that, if not all of that, from the BAU, so we do nothing. Most all of that looks like it's hydro. Under the clean energy standard options, it looks like hydro doesn't change. The only thing that changes, or the vast majority of things that change, is biomass. So we're effectively looking at a 50-50 split between biomass and hydro within that region. Next. Here we have the Delta, which again includes Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, or at least parts of all of those states. Coal-based generation declines 38 to 60% under the Bingaman Clean Energy Standard and Hall Clean Energy Standard, respectively. Coal then represents about 22% to 12% under Hall within the Delta region by the year 2035. Natural gas increases by about 60% and becomes the predominant source of electric generation within the Delta by that year, and ultimately becomes about 55 to 60% of the electric generation. Nuclear substantially declines, surprisingly, under the Bingaman scenario. It actually declines by about 70% and represents only about 9% of electric generation under Bingaman in this scenario, but under Hall, it remains fairly constant. And renewable energy, that small orange sliver up at the top, reaches about 4 to 7% of total generation in the year 2035. Next. And here we are in Florida, where coal declines by about 60 to 70% under the Bingaman and Hall proposals, and it ends up representing about 11 to 8% of total generation by 2035. So in order to make up for that loss of the coal, there has to be a fairly large increase in nuclear, and natural gas actually also declines as well. Gas declines by about a quarter and represents ultimately about 40% of our electric generation in Florida. Similarly, with nuclear, nuclear would represent about 40, 45% of the generation in Florida. But here's the sticker. It actually triples in the amount of estimated generation as opposed to a business as usual scenario. And that, again, that very, very small orange sliver up at the top is renewable energy, and that's about 3% in Florida under the clean energy standard proposals. So renewables do increase a bit in Florida, but it's a very, very small amount even after two decades. Next. And here we are in the last sub-region, the Southeast, which again generally covers Georgia and Alabama. Within this region, coal declines by about 73% for Bingaman, and for Hall it declines about 57%. And it ends up representing about 17 to 27% of total generation in the year 2035. And in order to make up for that, natural gas expands and nuclear expands. So natural gas increases by about half to represent about 30% of our electricity generation, and nuclear increases by about a third to about a half of total generation. Meanwhile, renewable, again, that tiny sliver up at the top, is just 6 to 8% of total generation by the year 2035. Next slide. And here's the addendum that I've been talking about. This is the newer analysis done by EIA in May of 2012. And the reason why we couldn't quite sync this up with the previous data is because EIA updated its business as usual scenario, its data, and also its cost estimates for these other technologies, as well as their ramp ability to actually become economically viable by the year 2035. A major change in here was EIA didn't believe that carbon capture and sequestration for coal could be done as quickly or as cheaply as what they previously thought. They also revamped their figures for nuclear to suggest that maybe that could be cheaper than what they had previously thought. And they did revamp a little bit on solar to suggest that it might not be as expensive as they had previously thought. But I do want to use this page as a reminder that all of these numbers are kind of in flux and are heavily dependent on EIA getting the numbers right. And if there is any sort of disruptive technology, cheaper wind farms, cheaper solar, cheaper storage, anything of that sort, it will pretty drastically change electric generation, maybe not so much for the nation, but especially for us in the Southeast. When EIA came out and redid their analysis, nuclear just shot up to be 55% of the region's total electric resource. It's just a massive, massive amount of nuclear that they were already predicting under the previous analysis, but it's even more so here. And something else I want to point out is that under a previous analysis, EIA estimated the Southeast might get up to 8% renewables by 2035. And in this addendum, they actually suggest that, no, they wouldn't even get up that high. It would only be about 6%. Then at the national level, we see a bit more break even between the different, the four different types of generation here of, you know, you basically have coal at 20%, renewables at 20%, and natural gas and nuclear each at about 30%. And so the numbers change ever so slightly, and there are a few different changes in the legislation, in the CESA legislation, that weren't in Bingaman's initial request to EIA, so very, very minute variable changes. But the big change, the reason why the numbers changed so much, is because the EIA changed their estimates for a business as usual and the cost estimates. So just wanted to throw this out here as there is additional information, but if you take everything as a whole, and if you were to look at everything as a whole, you can clearly see quite a few trends. There's a lot more nuclear, especially in the southeast. There's more natural gas. There's less coal. There are more renewables, but renewables still stay at a fairly low level. You have to keep in mind, when we talk about renewables, we're bunching in half a dozen different types of technology: wind, solar, hydropower, biomass. Different technologies all together make up maybe 20%. And so these are effectively the numbers that EIA has shown through these three different analyses to be a general direction that a clean energy standard would take this country. And with that, we'll go on to the last page here, which includes the link to the white paper itself. It's that bit.ly link. It's a little bit bigger. The link itself is fairly long, and so we wanted to try and shorten it, but clearly I wasn't all that successful in shortening it all that much. But just type in bit.ly/SACE Clean Energy Standard, and that should bring up the white paper for you as a PDF. There are additional fact sheets for each one of these subregions with some of these pretty charts available online at cleanenergy.org. Again, we've got them for all five of those subregions. And with that, you know, I want to thank everybody for getting on the call, and am looking forward to your questions.
Okay, Simon, thanks. We do have a couple of questions here. Let's see. We'll start with the first one. Any thinking about encouraging a redefinition of renewable and or clean energy sources?
Well, yeah. So I think I understand the question, but generally renewables are renewable resources, so not nuclear, not coal, not gas, things that we will not deplete in our lifetime, so wind, solar, biomass, hydropower, geothermal, marine, hydrokinetic. There might be some other fun ones that I'm forgetting, salinity changes and OTEC and that sort of thing. But generally there has been concern that the term clean energy is a bit deceptive because you are still using a fair amount of coal. 20% of our electric generation for the nation would still come from coal, and would mostly be incentivized under this, as well as the remaining questions about nuclear, especially with nuclear waste, and just a bevy of questions coming up now with natural gas. And so the clean energy standard is a bit of a misnomer and is actually more of a low carbon standard, not necessarily truly clean, squeaky clean, as what most folks would actually think. It's because the legislators are allowed to define it as they wish. So if they want to include bunker fuel as clean energy, they could just write it into the legislation and give it a certain credit, although I haven't heard of any desire to do that, but it is possible.
Okay. We do have another question, and Katie, if you're still on the line, your question is, why does that not include all of Virginia? And you aren't referencing the slide. So if you could go ahead and just maybe send another question in with a little more detail there, we can shoot that over to Simon.
Sure. Well, I think her question, if I can go ahead and quantify.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah. The map that I'm using is EIA's map. So it's not our map. don't blame us for it. But EIA had to separate the subregions based on transmission capabilities. And so effectively what EIA has done is, for most of the South, there's something called the Southern Electric Reliability Council that balances electric generation throughout the South except for Florida. Florida is special. They have their own little balancing entity. And with that, Virginia is not completely under the Southern Electric Reliability Council, or SERC. They're also partly under PJM, which is the Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Maryland planning area, and even parts of North Carolina are under PJM. But for simplicity's sake, EIA just went ahead and grouped Carolinas and Virginia into SERC.
Okay, great. Thanks, Simon. We have another question here. How accurate do you think the EIA 2035 BAU projections are? It seems that cheap gas is displacing more coal than is indicated in the projected BAU.
Yeah, and you know, this is getting into the methodology portion of EIA, and it really depends on who you ask. There's a really big Goldilocks effect. Some say it's too big, some say it's too small, some say it's just right. But certainly there are things that EIA has not taken into consideration. You know, Southern Company just recently announced that they were going to retire a whole bevy of coal and replace it with gas that they hadn't been anticipating. So clearly that wasn't in there. Other things, you know, I think you're potentially quite right on the natural gas side of things. There's a very strong criticism of EIA that their nuclear figures are just way too optimistic, not only cost-wise, that nuclear is not going to cost as cheaply as what the Department of Energy wants to believe, but also just the fact that effectively if you introduce a clean energy standard, can you build this much nuclear capacity? It's just a massive amount of nuclear. Can you build it in 20 years? And it's not just a financial question, which is a huge question, but it's literally it's a technical limitation that we might not have all the materials necessary or the know-how necessary or the permitting regulatory side necessary to get all that stuff done. So there's just a lot of really hard questions about the methodology, and it probably deserves a beer and a good long talk that we just can't do over the webinar. So I'll leave it at that.
Well put. Okay. The next question we have here, do the renewable numbers in this report include PV behind the meter?
Behind the meter, yeah, well, it does include photovoltaics. I will add an asterisk. The addendum numbers that I flashed up there, the most recent, the last slide that I showed there, is really only looking at utility scale generation. There is more solar that is added at the at folks' home, at a place of residency. In fact, there's more solar than there is at people's homes under that addendum than there is through utilities. And in fact, utilities, it appears that utilities start to shed solar in favor of having it on folks' homes. So it does kind of, but not comprehensively. And the figures I had been using previously throughout do include those numbers, and so they're not as high as what some folks would believe. And this goes back to that previously asked question of, do you think these EIA figures are real? You know, I think most clean energy advocates would look at a 0.5% solar generation for the country and just kind of laugh at it, and myself included. And so the numbers are as accurate as what EIA purports them to be.
Okay. We have another question that came in here. Why isn't there offshore wind in the standard?
Well, again, this is part of the EIA's methodology, but the EIA effectively is just pricing out offshore wind. The cost estimates for offshore wind in the United States are not entirely well known quite yet. However, estimates are showing, especially from the European side of things, that offshore wind is actually cheaper than nuclear. The estimates the EIA are using is that nuclear is way cheaper than offshore wind, and as such, it's including nuclear before it includes anything else. Anything that they would deem more expensive, like offshore wind. And so it's a again, I think it's another potential flaw in the EIA methodology of suggesting that offshore wind is not price competitive with nuclear.
Okay. And where does energy efficiency fit into these proposals?
Sure. So this is another interesting variable. You can actually define energy efficiency as a clean energy resource. You can actually, in the legislation, you can actually define it as such and give it a full credit. And there are much smarter people than I that are advocating for something of that effect, a energy efficiency standard that would help incentivize utilities to actually measure the effect of energy efficiency and to show its real benefits. In both of these proposals, to my knowledge, both the Hall and Bingaman proposals, neither one of them include a clean energy standard or credit do not include credits for energy efficiency. And so that is a factor in there. You know, I think we'd probably see a bit more energy efficiency if they were included in there. But we only ended up seeing for the South a reduction in energy by about 3 or 6% over a business as usual case, which is fairly low. And again, likely just because the cost of electricity has gone up.
Okay. And we have another one that just came in. How can we help to change the situation towards renewables?
That's a great question. And I think this is probably a first step now that folks have a bit more information on what a clean energy standard actually means. You can figure out where you kind of fit into the advocacy role of things. You know, I wanted to do my best to try and present this as just information so folks could make their own conclusions. But, of course, the legislation has not yet been introduced or written yet. You know, to be honest, I don't even know who would be interested in introducing it after President Obama endorsed effectively Senator Lindsey Graham's talking about a clean energy standard that pretty much shut down all bipartisan talk of it. But regardless, you know, just stay in touch with SACE and we'll let you know if and when a CES piece of legislation is introduced. We'll try to do some more analysis on it. But certainly get in touch with your congressional representatives and let them know what you think.
All right. I think that's a great way to wrap up our presentation today. Thank you all for attending today and for your thoughtful questions. We are really excited about our monthly webinar series, and we hope you'll join us again. Please visit our website, cleanenergy.org, for more information. It's on this last slide here. And if you do have additional questions, we encourage you to contact Simon directly at his email that's also on this last slide. The presentation and recording of today's webinar will be posted on our website via our webinar archive page, and you will receive a follow-up email that has those details in there as well. So thanks, everybody, and have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.